I'm Shalina Tobin, aka Posh Nosh Girl. Today I'm joined by one of the culinary industry's unseen legends, Derek Bulmer. For over 30 years, Derek ran the Michelin Guide's elite team of inspectors who would silently glide in and out of restaurants, rewarding chefs across the UK with elusive but extremely revered Michelin stars. Highly respected within the industry, Derek's opinion would make or break the fortunes of some of Britain's biggest restaurants, while checking out up to 30 establishments a week from the shadows of anonymity. He now has his own company consulting with the same restaurants on how to win and keep their Michelin stars and how to embark on a journey of continuous improvement. Welcome, Derek. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. And thank you for inviting me.
Thank you so much for your time. And I mean, for someone who's lived and breathed hospitality for the best part of 40 years, how has lockdown been for you?
Pretty dreadful, like for most people, I guess, really. It's boring. You know, there's nothing much to do. Working in hospitality meant that we haven't been able to do any work at all for the past year. So lots of exercise, the dog's never been better walked in his life. lots of DIY done. I've caught up with books I always meant to read, but never quite found the time to do. So kept busy, but I'm ready for things to go back to normal now.
Yeah, as we all are. And as mentioned in my intro, you were with Michelin for 30 years before you decided to leave, and you set up your own company called Marcini Consulting, which is a specialist restaurant and hotel consultancy. Talk to us exactly about what you do.
Yeah, I just clarify the Michelin timing. It was 33 years and I wasn't in charge for all that time. I was only actually in charge for the last 13 years as the editor of the guide. Previously to that, I started as an inspector, then I became deputy editor and then finally editor. But it was 33 years in total. Yeah, Martini. Well, when I retired early from Michelin, as early as I could, I decided I wanted to do something for myself and to get involved in the industry in a way that I hadn't been able to in the Michelin job, because you sort of work at arm's length with the industry when you're in the Michelin guide. You want the help and the cooperation of the industry, but you can't get too chummy with them on that sort of friendly basis, because Michelin isn't a consultancy. It's a book that's made for the readers of the guide, people who travel around and want to know where to stay and where to eat good meals, basically. So I was keen to do something where I could get more involved with people in the industry, which is really what I've done in Martini for the last 10 years since I started it. Mainly, I suppose it's quite a bespoke service that I offer. It's really quite a narrow service. I'm looking at people who want to win one or more Michelin stars. I do offer a broader service, critiquing hotels as well, but mostly people come to me because of the Michelin star background, and that's what they want to get. So I've worked with some of the big names in the industry, and I choose my clients carefully, not because it's not that I don't want to work with everyone, it's just that I know where the potential lies through my experience, who's got a chance and who hasn't. And what I didn't want to do was to waste anybody's money and my time with somebody who had no hope really of getting what they were setting out to achieve. So I select clients carefully, and that way you increase the chance of success.
So is your advice more about consistency and how to maintain the levels as opposed to just winning the stars?
Yes, I mean, people come to me for two reasons, primarily to win a star, but some people who have a star want to make sure they maintain it. And that's where I can offer a service to ensure that they consistently keep their standards up, because consistency was always the byword of Michelin. it was no good finding a restaurant that's fantastic one day and disappointing the next, because you're making a recommendation to a reader who might not have been there before, and they want to be pretty sure that when they go, they find the experience that they're expecting. So consistency is mightily important, and that's something I major on.
Yeah, and as you mentioned before, I mean, you were anonymous to now building relationships and advising directly with people. It must be so gratifying to actually tell someone what they need to do to achieve a star and, you know, actually help them.
Absolutely. Two points there. One is that I certainly started off anonymous, but 33 years is a long time to do this job to stay anonymous. And the higher up you go, the more you're meeting chefs and restaurateurs who remember you. And I think towards the end, I wasn't as anonymous as I would have liked to have been, shall we say. But that just goes with the territory. Actually, there's a funny little anecdote I can slip in there, that when I used to book a restaurant, I had about six names that I would use, rotate them. And whenever I made a reservation, I wrote in my diary the restaurant, the time, and the name that I'd booked in. Now, there was this one occasion when I was going to, I think it was called La Noisette. It was a Gordon Ramsay restaurant. I think it might have been in the Carlton Tower Hotel or somewhere down there. And obviously someone had interrupted me when I was making the booking and I hadn't written the name down. So I turned up to the restaurant with a colleague, not knowing whose name the restaurant was booked in. So I got to the maitre d' who was on the reception and said, "Oh, I've got a reservation in." And I tried my first name, Butler, I said, I think it was. He said, "I'm awfully sorry, sir, we don't have a reservation in that name." And I turned to my colleague and said, "Oh, did you book it in your name? Have you got it in the name of..." And I gave another name and he said, "No, sir, not in that name either." I said, "Do you know what? I think the secretary booked it. Have you got it in this name?" And he said, "I haven't got it in that name either, but don't worry, Mr. Ballmer, your table's right over here." So he knew who I was all along and he just wound me up.
Oh, that is so funny. Yeah. It's good to know that people have a humour around it, even though I'm sure they were probably very, very nervous to have you there.
I don't know if they were or they weren't, but... I don't think it helped restaurants sometimes knowing that you're there and being judged by Michelin. It's sometimes better that they don't know, because I think they make mistakes in nervousness that they wouldn't normally make otherwise. Yeah, I do.
How many of your clients have won Michelin stars that didn't actually have them before working with you?
Actually, it's been 12. 12 new stars that, I mean, the clients may well have won them anyway, with or without my help. So I'm not claiming that I've won any stars at all. It just so happened that while I was working for 12 of my clients, they were lucky enough to win stars, and they were all well deserved too, I have to say.
Yeah, fabulous. And I see you've got Claude Bossy at Bebendum. He's also a client. I love that building and its connection to Michelin.
Well, it's where I spent the first 10 years of my career, in that building. And I really was so sorry when we left that building, because I remember that you used to be able to walk out to lunch in about 100 restaurants from that place with, you know, a bit of a stroll maybe, but that was good after a big lunch anyway. And then we moved up to Harrow and it was nothing. There was nowhere to go and eat out there.
Oh,
so,
no.
We really missed that. So anyway... it's a fabulous restaurant he's put in there, and he's you know, really used the site well.
Yeah. And we visited, I guess, between the first and second lockdown. And that building, it really embodies the history of Michelin, as it started life as a tyre garage and now is a fabulous restaurant, just like Michelin itself started as a tyre manufacturer and is now just as famous in the culinary world. It's just so interesting.
Well, actually, I mean, you say it started as a tyre manufacturer. It still is a tyre manufacturer.
It still is, yes. Yeah.
And that is 99.9% of its business is still tyre manufacture.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of people didn't understand that the Michelin Guide was part of the tyre company. And then if they did, they couldn't understand what the connection was between tyres and gastronomy. which was simply because the Michelin brothers were gourmets of their day. And as they traveled around France, they wrote their own little list of favorite restaurants and, you know, that they liked to eat at. So that was initially given away free to chauffeurs. I think it was about the 1920s when they actually turned it into a commercial. And then started charging for it as a book. So that was the connection. But I mean, it's still tires is what Michelin
is still their main business.
All about. But yeah. What's interesting is although everything I say is dated by 10 years, of course, I have been out of Michelin 10 years. So when I say things, it could have changed. But it's interesting to note that then, 10 years ago, the turnover of the maps and guides department within Michelin was like 0.1% of the tire company, tiny amount of money. But in terms of publicity, the number of times the word Michelin was spoken on the radio, read in print or on TV, it was 50-50. So it was punching so far above its tiny weight. Mm-hmm. That it's sort of used as a good publicity tool for the tire company, really.
Yeah. And Bibendum was a great publicity tool for the company as well. And when I interviewed Claude Bossy, he told me that a regular customer of his said that Bibendum was supposed to be a very scary looking creature. I mean, have you ever heard that?
No, I haven't. No, I think the story
was scaring people off.
It was just a pile of tires that looked like a person at a tire fair, and somebody coined the name and said, let's make a mascot of this for the tire company. And, you know, he's one of the most widely recognized figures now in the world, really.
Absolutely. And I mean, I have seen pictures of Bibendum looking like a little bit like a mummy from the 19th century. So there may be a little bit of truth in that he was supposed to be scary. But the imagery and the stained glass windows at the Michelin building are a beautiful depiction of him.
Yeah, they are beautiful. They're all originals from posters that were made back in the 1920s or 30s, I think. So. Yeah, I mean, Bibendum has actually evolved over the years. He's got a bit slimmer, a bit healthier. He used to smoke big fat cigars back in the day, and they've gone because
it's
not anymore. No, and he's certainly slimmed down. He was more rotund in the early days, but essentially, he's the same guy still.
Yeah. So as you mentioned, you'd have left Michelin over 10 years ago, but from someone who's been on the inside, how has the Michelin Guide evolved from your perspective?
It always evolves. It follows the industry. Michelin doesn't create trends. It follows the trends and reports on them. So as the industry changes, the Michelin Guide has to change with it. Otherwise, it would become irrelevant and out of touch. So, I mean, the big change that I saw in the latter years was moving away from the formality of dining out, the starched tablecloth, if you understand what I'm getting at when I say that, to a more informal, relaxed environment where people more convivial, not so formal, and the food was just as serious, but the surroundings weren't, and that's one of the biggest changes. And then, of course, in my time in the late night in the 1990s and the early noughties, the pubs made a big resurgence, because before that, I mean, I remember pubs when I grew up, scampi and chips in the basket and a Ploughman's was about as good as it got, really.
Yeah.
And now look at them, and some of them are every bit as good as a top restaurant. So, you know, that they were coming up, surging up through the 90s and noughties, and really, really improve the depth of the gastronomic scene in this country. You see, in France, they always had a fantastic network of little restaurants, little bistros and brasseries everywhere you went. The Italians had their trattorias, the Spanish had their tapas bars, the Germans had their Weinstubels. And what did we have? We had these grotty old pubs, but now they changed and they became synonymous with Britain, particularly England, And really, for the first time, serving quality food that we weren't embarrassed about. And when foreigners come now, they all want to go to a typical English pub and have a meal. So,
Tom Kerridge is a brilliant example of that.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, he's right at the forefront of this. He was one of the very first to have a great pub, and of course, the first one to ever win 2 Michelin stars in a pub environment. So, yeah, Tom's done a lot for pubs in this country.
This year's awards saw the only 2 chefs in the UK to be awarded 3rd Michelin star. They were women, Helen de Roz and Claire Smith. How do you see the evolution of women in the industry in recent times?
Well, that's very encouraging, is what I would say to that. I mean, it's fantastic news that women have got to that level and are going into the kitchen in greater numbers than ever before. It used to be a very male-dominated, sometimes hostile environment to work. And I'm glad that that's changed and it's still changing, and that women are finding that, even without all that macho male, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? I don't know.
Testosterone,
exactly, going on. They can still produce fantastic food in a much calmer environment. So good on them. And I think we'll see that trend increasing in the years to come.
Yeah. I spoke to Sally Abay last week, and she's amazing in terms of promoting women in the kitchen and doing, you know, a lot of work for women empowerment.
We're seeing more and more of it, and I think that's a trend that will continue now, and it's great that we're seeing it.
Yeah. So we've also seen the introduction this year of the Green Star, awarded to recognise initiatives in sustainability. So I think it was 23 that have been awarded in the UK this year. That is real progress, isn't it?
Absolutely. That's why I say that the guide is evolving all the time. It never stays still. I mean, since I've left, and these are only the big headline changes, there'd probably been numerous minor ones that I don't know about. They started tweeting. They didn't do that when I left. They started putting pictures on Instagram. They started having a launch. Okay, the launch had to be a virtual launch this year because of the pandemic. But before that, they started having launches. And then the Green Star is a brand new idea that is reflecting the way that people are now thinking about food. They're much more conscious about the environment and everything around gastronomy in that sense. So yeah, it's that's a great new development. I think you'll see people striving to win a Green Star just as much as you will seeing them going for the normal star.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting, actually, I just did a little study on Escoffier, and actually he was quite into sustainability as well. And you're thinking, all those years ago, he was so ahead of his time. And it's actually just now that Michelin is coming out with the sustainability award. So it's taken some time to catch on.
It has, yes. But I think it just reflects the way we as a society are beginning to think more about sustainability in everything. The world's resources are finite. We can't keep just squandering them. So it's good that we're taking the time to think about that, particularly in our industry.
And in your opinion, has a standard required to win a star risen over the years?
Yes, it has, but that's only a reflection of where the industry has gone over the years. Mm-hmm. Michelin doesn't set a finite standard and say that's it. Because with a rising standard in the industry, eventually everyone would get a star. So they kept raising the bar imperceptibly every year as the industry raised its standards. So it's not something you would see from 1 year to the next, or not even in 5 years, but in a decade, you would see a difference in the sort of standard that's required for a star. I think back to the very first, I wasn't there for the very first guide, which was 1974, but I joined in 77, so it wasn't long after. And I think of the restaurants then that won a star, I doubt any of them would win a star today. Mm. And that's not because they're bad restaurants. They were good in their day. They were the best. They were. Yeah. It's yeah. just that the standard has yeah. risen so much, particularly in Britain, particularly. I mean, it was always good in France and Italy and other countries, but we didn't have a great reputation in the 1970s when I joined. Most of the food was frozen. Restaurant menus were as long as your arm. You could have steak 17 ways, Dover sole 17 ways. Every single vegetable was available because everything came out of the freezer. And I remember the first time I saw a handwritten menu. I think it was George Perry Smith, Hole in the Wall in Bath. And I thought, what's this? It's handwritten and it's a daily handwritten menu. It'll change tomorrow. And it was, at the time, it was groundbreaking. But of course, we take it for granted now. That just shows you where we've come in that relatively short period of time.
Yeah, absolutely. And do you feel that Michelin inspectors today have to be more qualified to cover the more diverse cultural culinary landscape that we have in the UK compared to other places?
Well, of course, they are more diverse anyway by the fact that, there are Japanese and Chinese inspectors now doing the work out in the Far East there. So in answer to your question, yes, but I know that one of the fortunate things about the British team was that most of the guides around the world outside of Europe were made in English. And the work that had to be done was done in English for the first time. So when we went to Scandinavia, for example, it was in English. When we went to Central Europe, Prague, Warsaw, Budapest, Athens, wherever it was done in English. So the British team always got first dibs, if you like, on these new destinations. And they've probably seen more of the world. And I know even since I've left, it's continued that trend and they travel the world now. Mm-hmm. So they've been very lucky in that sense. And they have gained an awful lot of experience they probably didn't start the job with. The team I left behind 10 years ago is still in situ. No one's left since I retired.
Oh, wow.
It shows you. So, and they'd all been there quite a time when I left. So I think they've sort of turned into jobs for life, really. Because I can remember when I started in the early days, the average length of an inspector in the job was 4 years. And when I became promoted to deputy editor, I wanted to do something about that because it took up to 6 months to train somebody. And then you get 3 years out of them, 3 good years, and they leave, and then you have to start all over again. So I started asking them when they left, why are you leaving? Mm-hmm. And what do you need different about the job to keep you longer? Mm-hmm. And it was always the same answer. Mostly they got married or they got a girlfriend and they said, it's the weekends away from home. My partner can't take.
Yeah.
And they were doing two week trips. They go away and for 2 weeks and come back a week in the office, away for another 2 weeks. And they said, it's just the weekends that are the killers. So I thought about it and I changed the routine of the working rhythm. I said, okay, now you're going away for 3 weeks at a time, but you're going to get home every weekend. You go home on a Friday night and you can start again on a Monday morning and you can have weekends at home. And since that, no one leaves.
Amazing.
They've been there for ages, everyone. So it just shows you, you've only got to sometimes make a small adjustment to keep people happy, because the people who do this job, they love food, wine, travel. I mean, this is what makes them tick. It's what made me tick for all those years. I just loved it. So you didn't want to lose all that experience and talent just because you couldn't accommodate their, their home life as well. So that changed. I mean, today, yes. I mean, still there will be the occasional 2 week trip. If you go to Athens, you can't nip back for the weekend really practically. So you have to go for a couple of weeks or at a time, but generally around the UK, pretty much everywhere you can get back at the weekend.
So, being
I assume it's still the same.
And being an inspector, I mean, it would really seem like the dream job, and it is for any foodie. But in truth, I mean, it must be very lonely to be going away for weeks at a time, dining alone more often than not. And yep. At your peak, I mean, the peak of your career, you'd hit 30 or so establishments per week. So what was the impact on your family life, and how did you manage to get past the loneliness if you did feel that way?
It was a style of life that suited me. It won't suit everybody. I readily agree with that. People who like a 9-to-5 job and like to get home in the evening to see their other half and their children, this is definitely not the job for them. They've got to be comfortable with their own company, and they've got to like travel, because there's an awful lot of travel in this job. It's usually a different hotel every night and two different restaurants every day. So, it only suits you if you're in love with all the things I said: food, wine, and travel. And you can make it work for you. But I understand it wouldn't be suitable for everybody, and that's why we during the interview process that is stressed heavily. How do you feel you'll cope with that part of the job?
Right. And was there ever like an impact on your health?
No. Well, touch wood, not to date anyway. I was lucky I didn't really put much weight on or anything. It's interesting that since we've been in the pandemic, I've lost weight. I've lost a stone. And that, I thought, why have I done that? I thought, well, for 40 years, you've been eating in restaurants every day. That's why. And now suddenly every restaurant's closed and you're not. So, I've lost weight. But it didn't impact on me at all. I mean, you do eat more than most people, but you don't have to eat everything you're given, of course. You have to eat enough to make a sensible judgment about a dish, but you don't have to clear the plate unless it's really good. And then you want to. No adverse impact for me or for anyone else in the team that I know, come to that.
And how's your own cooking skills?
I'd never win a star, if that's what you mean. I'm not at that level. I'm okay. I get by. I do most of the cooking at home here. My wife's very keen for me to do the cooking, and I enjoy doing it, I must be honest. So, I'm no chef, and I take my hat off to those that can consistently produce food of the standard that I became used to eating.
Well, have you been trying any of the new home kits from fabulous chefs?
I have tried a couple, yes. One of my clients, the Hackersang Group, started doing food boxes, and they sent me one to... so that I could try it out and give them some feedback on it. My son also did a food box kit last year as a sort of prototype for something he's now working on for the year going forward. And so, yeah, I've quite enjoyed that. It's better than nothing. It's better than not going to eat at all.
Absolutely. And it's, I find it phenomenal how the restaurant industry has just completely adapted themselves and brought fine dining home to us. And we've been trying out lots of different kits, and the quality is just gorgeous. I mean, there's no way we could make this kind of meal ourselves at home, but we're finding that, we're part of this kind of amazing creation because it's a finish at home kit. So you do some sort of finishes, and they're just brilliant. And I hope some of them actually continue. We had Core by Claire Smith a few weeks ago. Absolutely delicious. Really, really phenomenal.
Yeah, I hope they continue as well. And I hope that the restaurateur will be able to assimilate that into their business model, even when they reopen. I know one or two restaurants are saying that they're going to continue. So, it's just amazing how adaptable the industry was so quickly. Okay, we can't do that, so we'll do this instead. And it's been a real eye-opener.
Yeah, absolutely. And so going back to restaurants, I mean, do you find yourself judging the competence of a Michelin inspector now? So if someone didn't receive a star for a restaurant where you feel they should have, or vice versa?
No, I didn't used to like it when I was in the job in charge, when people were questioning your judgment, because I knew how serious and how conscientious we were as a team in making that judgment. Whether it was always right or not, I don't know, but we took it very seriously, as I know they do now, which is why I wouldn't question anything they do. If I feel I've had a good meal in a restaurant that deserves a star, I tell them, yes. I say, I've really eaten well there. Have another look, see what you think. But if they have a look and they say no, then I accept it, because I know the way the system works. And I know the care that goes into making it.
And when you were actually judging a few years ago, I mean, you must have been constantly judged by critics and journalists. Did you have to deal with any criticism?
I don't remember much personal criticism, if that's what you mean. There was plenty. There was always been plenty of criticism of Michelin, because I think journalists and the media generally are perhaps a little bit jealous of the reputation that Michelin has and has maintained for so long. And it's only maintained because the chefs give it credibility, because they want to win the thing, because they think it's fair and it's made properly, and they want to win a star. If for one day they decide that it's worthless, the guide will be finished, because it's them wanting to win it that gives it the credibility. But it usually means that therefore the media are anti it, because they don't like the importance that's given to one organisation. They perhaps perceive it as having too much power in the industry, and they want to deflate it, put the pin in Bibendum, you know, and see him deflate a bit. I don't really know. Or their favorite restaurant hasn't got what they think it deserves, and therefore the guide gets attacked for that reason. Could be any number of reasons, but
right,
you know, I only know that the conscientiousness with which the guide is made, and there are no freebies. Everything is paid for. There's nothing is taken, for nothing, and no favourites. No, oh well, it's him, so we must give him a star. Never any favourite. So everyone has a fair crack and is judged just the same as everyone else.
Yeah, and have you ever encountered a disgruntled chef?
Of course, lots of, yeah, but that's okay. That comes with the job, and so not just me, but the inspectors will be encountering disgruntled chefs all the time, I'm sure. People who believe they're worth more than they've got, and it's just knowing how to handle that situation, which you've got to, because it arises. Okay, I won't say it arises a lot, but it's not that unique. Let's put it that way. I remember there was a restaurant in Kenilworth I can't remember the name of it. It was a one-star restaurant, had a star for a few years, and I think I was still an inspector at this time, and I was the one to visit the year after it had lost the star. And I remember knocking on the door, and it was a house, actually. It wasn't a shop premise, and the waiter opened the door, and I said, I'm from the Michelin Guide, just annual visit to come and have a chat and check on what's going on. And the waiter called back to the chef, who was the chef patron, and he just screamed from the kitchen, "Get out, Michelin, you're not welcome here."
So
I never got over the threshold on that one, so that was about about as aggressive as it got, I think. It happens.
Yeah. And you've awarded some amazing chef stars. I mean, you've awarded people like Marco Pierre White, Gordon Ramsay, Heston Freemantle. Could you share any fond memories from that time with them?
Yeah, there's a couple of them stand out. I mean, when Gordon Ramsay was awarded the star. The normal procedure, because it's a big deal, three stars, particularly in the UK, where there haven't been many over the years. But I'm sure all of the countries adopt the same policy, is that you would go and visit the chef and let him know in advance, just so he could prepare himself mentally for what was about to happen.
Right.
Gordon didn't need that help, by the way, because he was already media savvy. It'd have been fine if we hadn't told him. But some chefs, you know, it might put them on the back foot, and they'd be getting phone calls and requests for interviews on TV, local TV, and things that they weren't used to. So it was just a sort of kindness to tip them off in advance. So the night before the launch of the guide, when Gordon won his third star, I booked a table there. And in fact, the director in Paris came over to join me just for dinner, to go and have a meal. And then after the meal, luckily we'd had a good meal, by the way. after the meal, I just happened to say to their waiter, who I think knew me anyway, "Is Gordon about tonight? Is he in the kitchen?" He said, yes, of course, I'll call him out. So he came out, and it's not the sort of thing you just blurt out straight away. We just sort of sat down and said, "How's things going?" And you chew the fat about the industry and, you know, what's going on, what are you hearing? And so we probably talked for about 15 minutes about nothing much in general. And then just as we were about to leave, I said, "Oh, by the way, Gordon, I just wanted to let you know that tomorrow morning when the guide comes out, you'll have three stars." And of course, he was delighted, and he insisted that we go into the kitchen and meet and shake hands with every one of his chefs. And they all had a work space about 3 foot wide in a tiny kitchen. And we said, and as we left, we said, "But please keep it to yourself until tomorrow morning." What a pointless thing to say, really. And anyway, we left the restaurant and we walked down Royal Hospital Road, and we're about probably 100 yards from the restaurant. And you know when, well, maybe you don't, but anyone who has ever been to a football match, if you're outside a stadium and somebody scores a goal, you hear this enormous roar come up. And that's what we heard from the restaurant, this enormous roar from the restaurant. So it obviously told the staff and the customers and everybody. And it transpired, I read in the paper the next day, that as we left, they got the champagne out and poured it round. Everybody had champagne on the house. Except us, we'd left. So, Gordon, if you ever do get to listen to this, I think you owe me a glass of champagne.
Oh, that's brilliant. It's so lovely that it was important to him that you met the entire team, though.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, because, I mean, it's a team effort, as you know, this thing. Yeah. It's not one man is the inspiration, but it's the whole team that make it happen day in, day out. Lunch and dinner and so on and so forth. So he wanted us to actually shake everybody's hand, even the pot wash, I think, got a handshake. So that was really touching. And then with Heston it was a little different, because I tried to contact Heston by phone, and I found out that he was in Madrid on the night before the guide came out. Something called Madrid Fusion that he attended every year with some like-minded chefs who were pushing the boundaries in, you know, in molecular gastronomy and that direction. And he went to it every year. And I found out he was in Madrid. So I managed to get his mobile telephone number off a member of staff, off the manager of the Fat Duck. I'm sure he wouldn't have given it to everybody, but he gave it to me. And I phoned Heston. And what I didn't know at the other end, he was in the middle of an interview with a chap from the Times newspaper about Madrid Fusion. And he was right in the middle. And I phone up and say, "Heston, how's it going?" And, you know, and again, I don't come straight out with it. I have a little chat. what are you doing out in Madrid? "Oh, that sounds interesting. You know, tell me about Madrid Fusion, blah, blah, blah." And then I say, "Look, the reason I called you is I want to let you know that tomorrow morning you'll have three stars. I hope you're happy with that." He went silent, absolutely silent. And I said, Heston, are you still there? Heston? And I'm just talking to myself. And I later spoke to him about it. In fact, he wrote about it in his book. He said, I just couldn't speak. I was just so overwhelmed that I couldn't speak. I heard your voice saying, Heston, and I just I couldn't answer you. And then I think he went and got plastered with all his pals from Madrid Fusion that night.
Right.
So he had a good time. But they didn't happen very much, and you wanted to make the most of it for their sake, because it was it's like an actor winning an Oscar, isn't it? You know, winning three stars is a big deal.
It's a very big deal.
The other side of the same coin is that, yes, I had to go and see Pierre Kaufman and tell him that he'd lost one of his stars from 3-2. So, you know, that's not such an enjoyable part of the job, but it's we felt just as responsible to do that as we did to do the other. So, but they were memorable times.
Yeah, yeah, that must be a very difficult part of the job. That must be the hardest part, actually, sharing.
Yeah, I think it probably was. One of the things I always did, I don't know whether it's done now, but I'm just saying as it was then, I would always be prepared to go and see a chef if they asked me to say, why have I lost my star? Anyone who lost a star, if they phoned up or contacted us and said, I don't understand it, because generally they didn't understand it. Why would they really, you know? I would always go and see them and say, sit down and say, this is why we took the star away, dish by dish, you know, say this was wrong, that was wrong. And give them detail on the reasoning. I felt that it was something we should do to help them, basically. And some of them took this information on board and came back and re-won the star again. Not many, it must be said, but a few did. So they found it useful.
I think that is really useful. I didn't realise that you were actually able to advise on that while we were working
it's
at Michelin.
Not so much advising as giving them feedback, really.
Okay. They were
hurting at that point because they'd lost something that had been dear to them. And I felt the only thing to be fair to do was to go and explain.
I totally agree. That is actually a very fair thing to do.
Yeah. So I would always do that. Always. So,
yeah. And how did you become an inspector in the first place? Tell me a little bit about your beginnings.
Well, I went... I made a decision to go into hospitality after I left school. I'm not quite sure why, really. It appealed. I probably saw the glamorous side of it. I thought I quite like walking around a swanky hotel in a DJ, so I went to hotel school in London, to Westminster Hotel School. I think it's called something else now, Westminster and Kingsway College or something, but it was Westminster Hotel School in my day. And I did an HND there, which was a sandwich course of 3 years, first year in college, second year working in the industry in all the departments, and third year back in the at college again. And from there, I left with an HND and went in to work for Trust Houses 40, who don't exist anymore, but at the time they were the biggest, I think they were the biggest hotel company in Europe at that time,
yeah.
THF. I worked in a small inn out in Hartford, tiny little inn where as assistant manager, you actually do everything, pretty much everything. You cover whenever necessary. I moved on to a large provincial hotel where I was a food and beverage manager in Oxford. And then I moved into London to Brown's Hotel, where I did, it was called personnel then, it's human resources now, I suppose. Looked after 200 and something staff running Brown's Hotel. And it was there that I saw the advert for the job. I was on a weekend. We did one weekend in for the assistant managers when you were on literally from Friday morning till Monday evening when you went home. on duty all the time with a bleep. You didn't have a mobile phone then, but it was a bleep that went off every time they wanted to get hold of you. And the bleep had finally stopped on Sunday afternoon, and I sat down with the caterer and was flicking through it, and I saw the job advertised, and I thought, my God, that sounds wonderful. I must do that. I just must. And I applied and was lucky enough to get the job, because I know how lucky it is, because when I was in charge and advertised, there was always 250 applicants. So, you know, for one job. So, yeah, I felt very lucky. And that was it from there on, really. And I never intended to stay for that long. I thought, I'll do this job for just a few years to get the experience and go to eat in some of these places I've just heard about, these names, you know, these fantastic restaurants that I'll probably never be able to afford to go to. And I thought, I love travel. So, but every time I thought about leaving, something came along and I got a promotion and got more responsibility, and it never quite happened, you know. So 33 years later.
Over the years, you as you mentioned earlier, you progressed to editor for GB and Ireland, and that's a job most people would dream of. Why did you leave in the end? What happened?
Well, it was more than GB and Ireland. It was also the main cities of Europe. So I also looked after the Nordic countries and the Central European countries, only the cities in them, because there was no country guide to Sweden or Czechoslovakia or wherever. Mm-hmm. There were just cities. So that was one of the things that came along and gave me another new interest after you'd assimilated GB and I. And then I got that interest. And then we helped with making the first guide in New York as well. So it began small and then gradually into Europe and then the world. And now, of course, they go all the way around the world. Why did I leave? Yeah, I mean, it's a very good question. They didn't want me to leave. They offered me another higher job to stay. I think they called it something like a European coordinator. I would have been responsible for all the Northern Europe countries with editors underneath me. And all I would do would be travel around these countries and eat. And that was it.
Sounds
really
heavenly.
Yeah. But then when I stopped and thought about it, I thought, I'm going to be in a in an airport every Monday and every Friday. And I'm not sure I want to, I've done it for a long time at this point. I thought, if ever I'm going to run my own business and do something myself, it's got to be now, while I've still got the energy, the enthusiasm, the drive and everything to do it. So I took the decision and retired and set straight up. But I at that time, I also worked for the Relais and Chateaux organization, which I'm sure you probably know about.
That's my favorite chain.
Yeah, well, they're an association of privately owned, privately run luxury hotels and top restaurants. And by top restaurants, I really mean 2 and 3 star Michelin. And they are very much worldwide. They've got about 500 members in 60 countries, I think, over 5 continents. Heavily European based, but it's more and more it's growing around the world. And they have freelance inspectors working for them, not like Michelin, who have full-time employees. They just want freelancers. And people who had retired from Michelin had the perfect background to freelance for Relais. Two French organizations, both based in Paris, both with very similar ways of working. I know, because I've worked for them both now. And I did that for about 6 years and got to some places that I hadn't got to with Michelin. So it was interesting the way it worked. But then the Martini work became too busy and I couldn't fit the Relais and work in as well. So I had to let that go just to concentrate on my own consultancy.
And so as well as Martini consultancy now, do you have anything else going on, or is it purely just...
Well, I'm about to help my son in a new project that he's set up. He's got a company called Wonderland, and he's opening a restaurant this summer called Park Row. Now, he's in partnership with Warner Brothers and DC Comics, so he's using all their characters as the inspiration in his restaurant. And it's a big beast. It's 300 covers, 22,000 square feet, I think. And there's about five different restaurants within this this thing. So obviously, I'm going to help him with menu planning and when he opens with quality control, giving him feedback and giving the chefs feedback. And he's got some high quality chefs already on the book. So
are you allowed to say who?
Yeah, I think so. Carl O'Dell used to be the head chef of Texture when that had a Michelin star. So he's got a great track record. He's going to be the head chef of what they call the Monarch, which is a 20-seater fine dining box, self-contained box, where it's going to be completely immersive gastronomy. So with a little bit of magic thrown in there. And then Kim Woodward, I think you may have interviewed her at some point.
Yes, I did.
And as you know, she was the first female chef of the Savoy Grill, and then she worked for D&D. And so she's used to big numbers in big operations, and she's going to run the other part of it. So, yeah, it's some exciting times coming up, and hopefully that will open this summer.
Well, it's a very exciting project, and so I'm really looking forward to that. Derek, we've got a few questions from our audience. So I've put some questions out, and just to find out what people would love to ask you. And so I've just got a couple of things here. In your opinion, which is the most underrated restaurant in London?
Oh, underrated. That's a tough one. It's a tough one because when you've been out for 10 years, as I have, I know how many hundreds and hundreds of good restaurants have opened since I left Michelin. So there are a lot of good ones that I don't even know now. I did like Adam Handling, and I thought that might have been worth a star. So
I'm totally with you on that one. It's probably one of my favourite restaurants, and we know Adam well, and it's quite sad that he didn't get one.
Yeah,
we were hoping he would.
But I see, I mean, he's a young man full of lots of ideas and very, very proactive. I mean, he's taken this box, he's taken it to a fantastic level so quickly from startup to, I mean, he really has done well with that. So I'm
it's
pleased.
It's probably one of the best quality boxes that we've had.
It's
really up there. It's fantastic. And he's thought about everything from, you know, from the sustainability aspect of it as well, and from from having recording himself showing how to make it, he's been brilliant.
I had some favorite restaurants in my day that didn't have stars. They didn't have to have a star for me to like them, and places like Scott's and Jay Shiki and the Ivy, I loved all those places, but they never quite made a star for whatever reason. I can't remember, but I like them just the same. So I'd put them on the list.
Yeah, it sounds like we've got very similar tastes, because Scott's one of mine. The Ivy, definitely one of my favourites as well. And that was actually the next question, so you've answered that.
Well, the thing is, I've actually got quite simple tastes when it comes to eating, and I think that's one of the things that I found, and I was frustrated by a little bit when I worked for Michelin, that the chefs, particularly the young chefs, they would overcomplicate dishes. They didn't know when to stop putting more ingredients and flavors on the plate. Escoffier, who you mentioned, he said, "Fais simple," years and years and years ago. Keep it simple.
Yeah.
And that would be my advice to any chef. Keep it simple. I'm not a fan of smears, foams and jellies, I call it. That, to me, that sums up a style of cooking, which I find too too prissy, too messed about with. I like things simple, bold flavors, high quality products that are very compatible and enhance each other. That's a winning formula for me. But there we go. That's just my opinion.
Well, it sounds like great advice. And which magazines, which foodie magazines do you like to read? Or non-foodie, actually. Let's just open it up.
Well, I keep up to date with the Catering Hotel Keeper, because I always did when I was in the industry. I read Big Hospitality Online all the time, and Eater London all the time, just to keep abreast of what's going on there. I actually like this is going to sound terrible. I like the Saga magazine. It's made for older people, I admit, but there's some brilliant articles in there, really are. And there's a section that Joe Fattorini writes about wine every month, which I enjoy reading. So yeah, amazing. The Saga magazine.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. One last question for you. Could you tell me something I couldn't possibly know?
Well, lots of my stories of Michelin you couldn't possibly know, but there's one
I've
probably
never.
One I've never really told, and that was This goes back again to my days as an inspector. There was a period at the end of the visiting year when you'd be dashing about everywhere because you were having second, third, and fourth opinions on candidates for stars, and lots of people would have to go to the restaurant. So you've got enough of a big enough dossier to be able to discuss them at the meeting at the end of the year. And it was that time of year, about September. That was when the guide used to come out in January. Mind you, it's gone back to January again now.
Yeah.
It was about September time, and I was going down to the West Country, and I remember having a lunch in Bath, and then dinner in Bath, and then I had a lunch the next day down in near Totnes in Devon. It was summer. The traffic was appalling. I had a booking. I just booked in my own for myself in a restaurant called the Maulster's Arms in Tuckenay. And it was owned by Keith Floyd at the time. Now, we all remember Keith Floyd. He was a bit of a character. And I got snarled up in traffic, and I phoned and said, I'm awfully sorry. I'm on my way, but I'm going to be late. I booked for 12:30. And then I phoned a second time. I was going to be even later. And they said, well, we're open till 2:30. I said, OK, that's great, because it's going to be nearly that when I get there. And he said, but don't worry. He said, your guest, we're looking after your guest. And I thought, well, that's crazy. I'm not eating with anyone, but I let it go. Anyway, I got to the restaurant about 2:15 in the end. And he said, glad you could make it. He said, I'm afraid to tell you, your guest is a little worse for wear. He's been drinking for a couple of hours now waiting for you. But I said, I'm not eating with anybody. He said, yes, you are. Yes. Come on, I'll go and take you. And he took me around the corner, and there at my table was a life-size teddy bear, like a Paddington. He was about 6 foot tall, sitting in the chair with a huge goblet of red wine in front of him. And he sat there throughout the whole meal.
Oh, how sweet.
That was Keith Floyd. That was the sort of humour he would put into things like that. But, just a great guy. We had a laugh about it when I did introduce myself after the meal. Not a story I've told before. So,
That's a lovely one. Thank you so much for sharing. And he definitely was quite a character, actually.
Oh,
and
yes.
There's so many amazing stories about him in the industry. It's really lovely to hear that one that I haven't heard before. Well, thank you so much for your time. And guys, you can find Derek through his website, which is martiniconsulting.co.uk. And I'm at poshnoshgal at Instagram. And if you guys enjoyed today's interview, please subscribe, rate, and review. It really helps others find me.